Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on June 25th, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Ataka Nagara Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's another talk on jhana, leading up to our series on the three marks of existence. And I think we're probably going to spend one more week on jhana. And I'm gonna read the new or the rewritten introduction just so it's on the record. And the sutta itself is rather short, so I don't think we'll be here too late. As with all of the Buddha's teachings, jhana meditation must be seen within the overarching context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths to be useful and practically applicable. The Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths as the requisite condition for fabrications. Fabrications are the glue that binds confused thinking to ignorance, obscures reality, and establishes stress, disappointment, and suffering, in a word, dukkha, as the common human experience. And it's in doing a little bit more research on dukkha, the Pali Texas site has a great, no, it's not great. They have a useful Pali to English dictionary. The reason why I say it's not great is it's not very well formatted and it's kind of jumbled up. But when you look at dukkha, and the Buddha teaches it this way too, dukkha is not meant to describe only a very extreme level of suffering. In fact, the word dukkha applies to very, very subtle levels of disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences. And we're going to get more, that's the reason why we're going to do this over the summer, is get more into what that really means. And the broad experience of encountering dukkha at the point of context. Jhana means meditative absorption. The Buddha teaches in a general way four levels of meditative absorption or deepening concentration. As can be seen here, these four levels are not in a practical sense strictly defined. A meditator gently flows from the first to the fourth jhana as a direct development of jhana meditation as the Buddha teaches meditation. The four levels of meditative absorption can and should be mindfully observed as concentration increases. In fact, that's the reason why the Buddha taught this, to show us that our meditation practice is progressing the way it should. Give us a benchmark, a way of evaluating in a skillful way our meditation. I just wrote a response to something that was posted on Tricycle. I haven't posted this yet because it ended up being another book in itself. But the article was about how to evaluate your meditation practice. And in modern meditation practice, it was a very useful and skillfully written article. But it was so confusing and elaborate. I don't know how anybody could actually find it useful. And the contrast to what the Buddha said to look for in meditation is just these four levels of jhana as a way of evaluating our meditation practice. The four levels of jhana are important, are impermanent, and are taught by the Buddha to provide a skillful means to notice ever-increasing levels of meditative absorption. That's kind of in a nutshell. Does everybody get that last paragraph? Jhana practice is not to be seen as anything extraordinary or the levels of jhana unattainable, which is how it's often taught. Jhana meditation is extraordinary in developing concentration and entirely ordinary to those actually developing the Buddha's Dhamma. It's ordinary because it's what we do. In other words, the Buddha didn't teach something. He didn't teach one meditation for people in the beginning, and then as you get more experience, you can have this meditation, and if you're really on the verge of awakening, use this one. He taught one single meditation method for the sole purpose of deepening concentration. Jhana meditation is not another opportunity for fabricating experience through continued confusion or continued desire encouraged by misguided instruction. Free of grasping after, these four levels of meditative absorption are a clear direction to recognize that jhana meditation is actually developing concentration, while avoiding creating further distraction due to fabricated methods. This aspect of right view then remains free of conceit or eye-making that would otherwise create confusion, contradiction, frustration, and distraction within jhana meditation practice. The sequencing of the additional descriptions of non-physical meditative experience that follows the descriptions of four levels of jhana should not be seen as advanced levels of meditation as is commonly presented, and certainly not as levels of meditative absorption achievement. That's something that me and that other gentleman differ on. These fabricated physical meditation experiences, often mischaracterized as advanced levels of meditation, were part of the doctrines of Siddhartha Gautama's early teachers, Alarika Lama and Udeka Ramaputta. Having mastered these fabricated common meditation techniques, he immediately dismissed them as they do not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to self-unbinding, to self-awakening or unbinding. These methods only seek to establish a fabricated reappearance in the dimension of nothingness or all the other dimensions that we'll talk about. In other words, the Buddha is saying that type of practice is simply seeking to establish yourself in imaginary realms, so common during the Buddha's time, rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads, and carrying through to today in most modern practices, are simply a form of continued eye-making, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Is that clear? So they sound, there's even a certain level of enticement to establishing this, especially from a mind fabricated to want to continually establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. It's the nature of anatta. And when you can throw something out there that sounds mystical, the realm of nothingness or the realm of infinite consciousness or infinite space, it sounds great, doesn't it? I mean, I want to go there. The initial reason why I got interested in so-called Eastern religion is I thought that it taught a way to live forever, to travel without my body all over the cosmos and all kinds of other interesting things. It took me a while to realize that that's just fabrication and it's just continued eye-making, isn't it? There's no way to know that this is true. I mean, I've had experiences of traveling the cosmos without my body, and it was just an imagination. It was induced by a certain way of thinking. There was no validity behind it. And the Buddha recognized that very quickly.
It's a nice way of not having to deal with what's happening to you here and now.
Exactly. And when I can establish myself in the realm of nothingness, which is what one whole school of Buddhism teaches, that there's no such thing as a self, there's only emptiness and nothingness, directly contradicts what the Buddha taught, but it's a complete escape, isn't it? It doesn't last, though. There's no real refuge in that way of thinking. Why? Because it's fabricated. I don't want to get into too much commentary, so I can get through this. When seen in the proper context, any attempt to establish a self in speculative, non-physical realms, including imaginary realms of emptiness or nothingness, or a non-dual existence, is abandoned as these methods are seen as misguided strategies to continue to ignore ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Of course, that's within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Confusing a concentration practice with a practice that teaches meditative achievement as self-establishment in non-physical imaginary realms can only continue that ignorance and continue eye-making. These modern meditation practices completely contradict the Buddha's Dhamma and the stated purpose of his Dhamma. The realization that it is a lack of concentration that results in grasping and clinging mind is insight Siddhartha developed prior to his awakening. That makes sense, doesn't it? That if our minds aren't concentrated on simply what's occurring, we are prone to grasping after and clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
As such, the Buddha could have taught to simply avoid any fabricated non-physical self-reference. There could have been a rule. Don't go there. But of course, he understood the nature of conditioned mind. One of the breakthroughs of understanding Siddhartha had was the skillful insight into the powerful but very subtle strategies that a mind rooted in ignorance will develop and cling to in order to continue ignorance. As common during the Buddha's time, as are dharmas that encourage modern teachings that encourage meditation practices that teach subtle but convenient methods for ignoring ignorance are common, unskillful, and in the Buddha's way of thinking cruel, in my way of thinking cruel, especially in this room, for me to teach a practice, even though it might be fun and easy to teach, mantra meditation, we can all do Om for 20 minutes, and let's go home. I'll call it that. We did good tonight. We had a meditation on Om. But knowing what I know, it's cruel to teach you that, or teach anybody that, isn't it? Do you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It might be fun. It might bring more people in. We could call it the Om Meditation Center. But it's simply cruel. It's misleading. It continues people's ignorance. It continues suffering. With profound wisdom, the Buddha realized the attraction of continuing self-establishment in fabricated non-physical realms. He understood that the most effective method of understanding the foolishness of these doctrines that encourage continued eye-making would be to explain these common experiences in the context of jhana meditation, meaning incorporating these other practices. In this way, jhana meditation demystifies these non-physical fabrications. When seen in the proper context as ordinary fabrications, these wrong views are simply recognized and abandoned. The Buddha typically told his followers to go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana. This is instruction on establishing seclusion as the proper environment for a meditation practice with the purpose of developing ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption. Jhana meditation is the only meditation method the Buddha taught. Jhana meditation is established in the Satipatthana Sutta, the primary sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness, and the suttas here and many others on jhana. It is the initial section of the Satipatthana Sutta that teaches increasing concentration and calming the mind by being mindful of the breath in the body. This is the first foundation of mindfulness that begins the process of jhana. The second and third foundations of mindfulness continue the establishment of concentration by ending distractions arising from reacting to or clinging to feelings and thoughts as they arise and pass away, always returning mindfulness to the breath. The instruction found in the Satipatthana Sutta relates directly to the four levels of jhana. In this way, using meditation for continuing to grasp after any fabricated self-establishment is clearly recognized and gently abandoned. In other words, the Buddha taught very skillfully these four foundations of mindfulness as a counter to what he saw that was going on in the so-called spiritual community of his time. And it is in the simple directness that it's most effective. By avoiding the distraction that would arise by reacting to feelings and thoughts or seeking imaginary self-establishment in non-physical realms, the joy of seclusion and deepening concentration is established and recognized. The reason why I'm spending so much emphasis on this is these speculative non-physical realms are not just these with having grandiose mystical labels applied to them. Any fabricated establishment in my mind is exactly the same thing, including the idea that I decide that I am going to be the best meditation teacher there is, and that immediately starts creating tension within me, stress, doesn't it? And distraction towards being the best meditation teacher rather than being the most effective meditation teacher. And the same applies to anything we can decide that we're going to be. You know, pick a list, anything that it is, that we establish in our minds, in our imagination, is a fabricated self-establishment. Even if it's true. If you're creating something in your mind that you now have to live up to and present to the world as who you are, that's a fabrication, isn't it? The underlying behavior might be exactly the same thing, but the underlying behavior is just what is done. There's no eye making or craving or clinging attached to it. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Do other meditative practices not address the impermanence? That's what I liked about this. It makes it very clear that each of these four stages, jhanas, are impermanent.
Yes, so, in an observation of impermanence.
Yeah. I mean, he's not selling anything that can't be sustained.
Yep, exactly that. And there's nothing that the Buddha taught that cannot be directly experienced. Again, if it couldn't be, he'd be teaching something fabricated, wouldn't he? His own teachings would contradict his teachings. I've never come across any meditation technique that actually can teach directly impermanence, although the Vipassana movement presents itself as the whole point of Vipassana is to understand impermanence. Because the approach and the technique lack the framework to actually recognize impermanence in the way the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught to recognize, this is what we're going to get into in a couple of weeks, a very specific impermanence. It's impermanence as one of three factors of the three marks of existence. And so most people understand that everything is impermanent. We just don't take it to the deepest level and apply it to the way we look at ourselves in relation to the world. We believe, even though all evidence points to a difference here, we believe that we can establish a permanent self, at least in our minds. That's a fabricated establishment. That's the essence of anatta, a not-self belief. And so the Buddha didn't teach a very broad application of being mindful of impermanence. Understanding the impermanence of the physical world is a consequence of understanding our internal relationship with impermanence. And that's the important thing, and that's what we're going to get into in a much deeper way. It's not helpful to be mindful of everything that's impermanent. Pick one. I mean, I can understand that even a mountain is impermanent, but it doesn't really do me much good. That's a truth, isn't it? Even mountains wear away, but it doesn't relate to Dhamma practice, does it? It has nothing to do with it. So it's not a useful teaching. Thank you. As concentration increases, directed thought and evaluation is abandoned, and a pleasant abiding is established. This relates to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, being at peace with the present quality of mind. This quality of mind is known as equanimity and gradually increases as jhana meditation continues within the framework and guidance of the Eightfold Path. The remaining sections of the Satipatthana Sutta then show how to apply ever-deepening levels of meditative absorptions to other significant themes of the Dhamma. The entire Satipatthana Sutta is not meant as meditation instruction, which becomes obvious when seen in the proper context of the Buddha's Dhamma as detailed here. The Buddha's Dhamma reunites the mind and the body and overcomes the self-identification, seeking to establish a self in fabricated, magical, mystical, and imaginary planes of physical non-existence. Often, modern meditation practices such as generalized insight or mindfulness meditation are taught as merely noticing thoughts and feelings, calling noticing in this manner mindfulness. Intentionally noticing is holding in mind internal phenomena during meditation. This is a subtle but powerful reinforcement of distracting phenomena and the most common strategy used in modern meditation practices. These forms of meditation will distract the confused mind further and continue to ignore ignorance of Four Noble Truths and ever-changing phenomena now becomes the sole focus of insight or mindfulness. You see how that can never lead to, it's always a distraction, because if we're always focused on impermanence and change is always there, what we're really focusing is on the problem and not solution. It doesn't bring an answer, does it? It's just a continual supply of material for distraction is all that it is. When seen in the overarching context of the Buddha's Dhamma and in the context of engaging in jhana meditation solely for deepening concentration, grasping after self-establishment in imaginary and fabricated mind states is seen clearly as intentional distraction used to continue to ignore ignorance of Four Noble Truths. As concentration increases, refined mindfulness is established, supporting the integration of the Eightfold Path, developing a profound understanding of the three marks of existence. And this is just a definition of terms that we'll touch. Rapture is a word often used in the Dhamma to describe a profoundly joyful engagement with a Dhamma. Directed thought is mindfully directing thoughts away from internal idle chatter and to the breath in the body. This relates directly to the Buddha's instructions for right meditation found in the beginning section of the Satipatthana Sutta. Is that an improvement? Does everybody understand now what directed thought means? Mm. Good. Evaluation follows directed thought and provides the skillful method of noticing when distracted by thoughts and feelings, and then intentionally directing mindfulness back to the breath and the body. Evaluation is dispassionate and avoids criticism of self or method during jhana practice. The same thing that you hear me say all the time. Be gentle with yourself and be gentle with your meditation practice. Samsara is a continued state of ignorance, prone to confused, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointment. In the Atatakanagara Sutta, this sutta, the householder Dasana, Dasama, inquires of Ananda if there is a single quality taught by the Buddha that would result in release from all ignorant views, all views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. Ananda explains that it is a well-concentrated mind developed through right meditation that results in abandoning the defilements of greed, aversion, and delusion, and bring to cessation all fabricated views. The single quality of awakened right view is a culmination of wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path. The Buddha describes awakened right view as having a profound understanding of suffering, meaning knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regard to the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. And that's directly relates to the Four Noble Truths. The Atatakanagara Sutta, the single quality for awakening. On one occasion, Venerable Ananda was at Baluga Gamaka near Visali. At that time, a householder, Dasama, from Atatakanagara, was nearby on business. Completing his business, Dasama went to the monastery, the local monastery, Kukata Monastery, to ask a certain monk a question. "Where is Venerable Ananda staying? I would like to see him." The monk told him that Ananda was where Ananda was, and Dasama left immediately. Upon meeting Ananda, Dasama bowed and sat to one side. He had a question for Ananda. "Venerable sir, is there a single quality taught by the Buddha to be developed so that the unreleased mind of a Dhamma practitioner who is mindful, ardent, alert, and resolute in the Dhamma would attain release and security from the yoke of clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths?" Ananda replies, "Yes, there is, friend Dasama. When a Dhamma practitioner, secluded from sensuality and other unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana. This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Despite the pleasure of this first jhana, they understand this first jhana is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation." Another way of looking at that first jhana is it's beginning in a meditation practice right where we are, which is a mind that is distracted and requires initially first a physical seclusion from the distractions of the world, isn't it? That's why we go to a secluded spot. It's another reason why the Buddha didn't teach any other forms of meditation that don't require that initial seclusion, such as walking meditation is one of the things that I'm thinking about. And as we understand the benefits of this practice, we are joyfully engaged when we start this, don't we? We feel, at least we should, we feel that joyful engagement with the Dhamma as we start to sit down and direct our thoughts towards our breath and away from distracting thoughts, that ongoing story that we're telling with ourselves.
I always see that first step in establishing my meditation practice as almost like a gift to myself.
Exactly, yeah.
Because I'm finally bringing up the intention that this is what I want to do, because I'm starting to see that I really, really need this.
Yes, and that's it is an aspect of right intention, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon all fabricated views leading to craving for and clinging to a fabricated existence. And so it takes a well-concentrated mind. It follows that right intention. This is one of the tools the Buddha gave us, the only meditation tool, to do just that. And then he gave us seven other factors of the Eightfold Path to continue that. And so that first jhana is simply joyful engagement with what's occurring and directing our thoughts to our breath, and then evaluating, meaning simply judging clearly, am I doing this correctly? Meaning, am I being mindful of my breath? And when I find myself caught up in my thoughts again, I simply direct my thoughts back to my breath and my body. And that's the evaluation part. Am I doing this? And you really don't have to say, am I doing it right? Because it's so obvious what it is. It's so simple. Right meditation is mindfulness of the breath. That's jhana practice. And in the beginning stages, the evaluation is, am I doing that? Directed thought and evaluation. I guess you could say you're evaluating whether your thoughts are directed properly. As they continue meditation, they enter and remain in the second jhana. The second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So again, we all experience that. We first come to meditation, usually with a relatively distracted mind from what's been going on in our lives, and we sit down and we take pleasure in that initial act of directing our thoughts. And then as our concentration deepens, we can recognize and appreciate the fact that, yes, concentration is deepening. And the reason why the Buddha teaches this flow from the first jhana to the second jhana is so that we recognize that our directed thought and evaluation is bearing fruit in deepening concentration. Has everybody experienced that second jhana, noticing an increase in concentration and taking pleasure in that? Yes? The joy of concentration permeates their entire mind and body. Despite the pleasure of this second jhana, they understand this second jhana is fabricated and permanent and subject to cessation. One thing I was thinking about when I was rewriting this, and I didn't think about it before, but this, again, the brilliance of the Buddha is always astonishing to me when I see it like this. For most people, being able to establish just a mere measure of increased concentration and a pleasant feeling would be enough, isn't it? In fact, the Buddha sees this, that we could easily get stuck right here and say, this is good, this is all that I want. I don't need to go any further. In fact, a lot of meditation practices end right here, right at the second jhana. But he realized that this, even at that level, the experience itself is still fabricated. So we taught to continue to deepen concentration. Free of directed thought and evaluation, the joy of concentration permeates the entire mind and body. Despite the pleasure of the second jhana, they understand the second jhana is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. Nothing to hold on to. Continuing meditation, they enter and remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. Despite the pleasure of this third jhana, they understand this third jhana is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. So as we deepen our concentration, directed thought and evaluation falls aside, even if it's just for a few brief moments, and we're deepening our concentration. As our concentration deepens, we experience a mind of, again, even if it's only momentary, a mind of equanimity. A mind of equanimity is a calm and peaceful mind without the other components of directed thought and evaluation. It's simply this pleasant abiding in a well-concentrated mind. Have you all experienced the third jhana?
Yeah.
Nothing extraordinary about it, is there? Has anybody not, or think that they have not experienced that third jhana?
I'm not quite sure if I can say that.
Do you notice a quality of mind that, again, even if it's momentary, is not grasping after anything, including the idea, am I doing this right, or is it bearing fruit, or that any type of that evaluation?
It would be extremely fleeting.
But... there, nevertheless. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth.
It's just something that is, as soon as my mind goes to that, it's gone.
And that's why we need to continue to develop concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting part here. because in that case,
the evaluation part, I think that's where it hinges.
Well, what
you're no longer evaluating is this if this is what's going on, or actually more like, is this good or bad?
What you're describing is entering in the third jhana, even for a moment, and then falling back into the second, or maybe even the first jhana.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and that these are impermanent. They're fluid. And most of us, do just that. We flow from the first to the second to the third, maybe the fourth jhana, and then we have that thought again. And is this equanimity? Well, if you think about it, you lost it. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't, because that simply tells you that you're back in a preliminary level of jhana, if I can use that word. You're back in the first or second jhana. Nothing wrong with it. Recognize it. What do you do? Come back to your sensation of breathing, and you'll deepen that even further.
Yeah. It feels like a process of relaxing into it.
That's another way of saying it, yeah. And part of that is just, it follows with right intention, and it has to do with wholehearted engagement with the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody that can or should judge your meditation practice, including the Buddha, including me. It's up to you, but the Buddha, it's not an arbitrary way of judging it. That's why the Buddha teaches jhana. We know for ourselves that it's bearing fruit, and that we're developing these ever deeper levels of jhana, and that we can recognize them. If they weren't pointed out, we wouldn't know to even look for them, would they?
Where does effort come into this? Is the third jhana where effort falls away, or is that still there?
Boy, that's a great question.
Right
effort is... The Buddha describes right effort in sometimes in this way. Right effort runs circles around right view and the implication of the entire Eightfold Path, because right effort is the very well-focused effort to develop the entire Eightfold Path, including right meditation. It's the part of the Eightfold Path that is there to keep us well-focused on what we're doing. So right effort is the effort to do this correctly.
Right. So that goes all the way through.
Right through. Right. And you could say that all of Dhamma practice is an expression of right effort, but it's also an expression of developing right view too. I'm going to leave it there. Get too deep into the Eightfold Path, but that's another time. Continuing meditation, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity and mindful. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness. Has anybody had that experience, pure, bright awareness in your meditation? Again, even if it's for a brief moment? Anybody? Everybody? Nobody? Has anybody? I will bet you have. You just haven't noticed it. And again, it's rather fleeting. Well,
on retreat.
Pardon me? Who said that?
Wait,
on retreat? Yeah, well, that's true. So
yeah, on retreat.
We all need to go on retreat, but...
No, she might be saying that...
No, I thought experience before jhana on retreat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so it is just another level that we're all developing. And I would say that you're all, if you've gotten to the third jhana, you probably have touched on the fourth. And you can also see the fourth jhana as the culmination, although the Buddha doesn't teach it that way. You remember in the, it's not the Sariputta Sutta, but where he's using Sariputta as an example, he describes how Sariputta developed these very deep levels of jhana, and then he says, and yet he understands there's ever more deeper levels. And so that establishment of equanimity can be seen as the culmination of Dhamma practice, but yet we can always go deeper into concentration. Even though that mind of equanimity has been established. I was asked this question, I think, a couple of years ago from a beginning student. He says, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? Well, why wouldn't he? It's such a pleasant abiding. The implication there was that to him, meditation was a chore that he wanted to get through and leave behind. Ananda continues, as concentration jhana deepens, their mind is unbound, spacious, free of the continuing yoke of ignorance. They are imbued with unlimited goodwill, with compassion, with empathetic joy, their mind resting in equanimity. I just want to make a note here. Even so, this Dhamma practitioner understands that this release through goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy and equanimity is itself fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. That's not a condemnation or a diminishing of the fourth jhana. It's simply a reminder that even this is impermanent. Why is that important to a meditator? So that we don't cling to it and insist that whatever quality of mind I've developed in meditation, no matter how pleasant it is, if I insist that I must take it off my cushion, we've lost it. We've lost equanimity, haven't we? Another subtle teaching here about jhana meditation is it's just that. What's that saying about Vegas? What occurs in Vegas stays in Vegas. What occurs on our cushion stays on our cushion. Now we're gonna call it Vegas meditation instead of jhana meditation.
Now let me catch it.
And that is such a profound teaching that's included here. What happens in our meditation practice stays there. Meaning whatever we've thought about, whatever we've felt, they're all temporary. The four foundations of mindfulness teach us. And that fourth foundation of mindfulness is what we can take off our cushion into our mundane moment-by-moment life. Meaning to be mindful of the present quality of mind without the need for it to be any different than it is. That's a profound aspect of equanimity, isn't it?
Okay.
Does everybody understand what I just said? What happens on a cushion stays on a cushion?
It surprised me, actually. You do say that.
Yeah, but the seclusion that we establish on our meditation cushions naturally comes with us. Again, another way of saying it is that off our meditation cushions, we then shouldn't be spending time thinking about, did I do this right, or what a wonderful experience it was, or anything. The important thing to notice about your meditation practice is that your concentration is increasing. Nothing else. And if you can notice, keep that in mind about your meditation practice, then the actual feeling of the meditation session isn't all that important, isn't it? Because if you're engaging in the proper practice, no matter what you think of your meditation session, it's going to bear fruit. It's going to deepen concentration, isn't it? Again, that's the right view to have about meditation too, jhana practice. I'm going to read my commentary here. Ananda's description of ever deepening concentration is similar to the Buddha's description of Sariputta's mastery of jhana in the Anuppada Sutta. Maybe we'll do that again. Back to Ananda. Remaining well concentrated, they reach the end of the defilements. If they do not reach the ending of the defilements right then and there, through their continued right effort, the five lower fetters will fall away. Those are self-identification, grasping at rituals and practices, doubt and uncertainty, sensual craving, and ongoing deluded thinking. Furthermore, having abandoned self-identification with form, having abandoned aversion, having abandoned self-reference, now here and now there, they enter and remain, and this is where the Buddha's The appearance here in this sutta of what I'm about to talk about shouldn't be seen as a level of meditative absorption. It's just included in this order. But you'll see that there's no importance placed on this. Let me go back to the beginning. Furthermore, having abandoned self-identification with form, having abandoned aversion, having abandoned self-reference, now here and now there, they enter and remain in the perception of the infinitude of space, the dimension of infinite consciousness. In this sutta, this is all broken down with the same repetitive introduction to these. Mm-hmm. I'll just include them all in one because they're the same thing. Then the dimension of infinite consciousness, then the dimension of infinite nothingness, and then too the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Even here, they understand that any phenomena connected to five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, consciousness, is impermanent, stressful, a disease, painful, and affliction, and as such, anatta, not self. I can't think of a more powerful condemnation of seeking to establish yourself in non-physical realms. And this is something. This isn't the only sutta. The Buddha says this repeatedly. Don't do it. He could have started out this teachings on jhana, but it was important, again, the brilliance of the Buddha, to first establish these are the four foundations of mindfulness. All of the rest of this is just extraneous distraction. They disregard these phenomena and incline, these are accomplished, those that understand jhana practice and the Eightfold Path, they disregard these phenomena and incline their mind to the cessation of ignorance. Nothing remains to provoke the becoming of further ignorance and the birth of continued suffering. Again, the inclusion here is important. The implication is that hoping to establish ourselves in these imaginary realms is simply a continued provocation of ignorance. They will enter into pure, bright awareness, a pleasant abiding, totally unbound from clinging to wrong views. I love this line, and it is my interpretation, but never to lose their mind again. This, my friend, is a single quality taught by the Buddha to be developed so that the unreleased mind of a Dhamma practitioner who is mindful, ardent, alert, and resolute in the Dhamma, they would attain release and security from the yoke of clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Upon hearing these words, the Sama remarked, "Venerable Ananda, it is as if a Dhamma practitioner were seeking a single opening onto treasure and all at once realized 11 openings to treasure. In the same way, I was seeking a single doorway to the ending of all fabrications. All at once you taught me 11 doorways I can take, all leading to the single point of cessation from fabricated views." In my commentary, these 11 doorways are the four levels of jhana, the four fabricated realms that he just described, but they could be any realm, and the three marks of existence. And so understanding these four levels of jhana and the fabricated realms and ultimately the three marks of existence is what the Buddha is teaching. Now, Jen asked me that question earlier today. I briefly read that email. I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing. But does that answer your... or just explain your confusion you had with the 11 doorways?
Yeah, but the four fabricated realms, are they, I mean, that's the perception and non-perception.
Yes.
Is that what that was? And that's not, it was a teaching of the time, but it's not a teaching that's important.
Oh no! It's yeah.
Is that right? But then it seems like he's saying it's important here.
It's absolutely important. Yes, and that's kind of the whole point of my long introduction to the Jhana Suttas, but also this Sutta. The Buddha is, and Ananda here, is teaching us that those fabricated realms are to be recognized and abandoned. They're not something to be developed. Just like the four levels of jhana are something to recognize as developing, and just as developing insight into the three marks of existence. Seeing these things clearly is what is referred to as the doorway. It's what we can...
Developing jhana is eventually recognizing sort of the four fabricated realms, or seeing them and then abandoning them.
Yes, the doorway is recognizing the fabricated nature of it.
Okay.
And then that concluding reference to the doorway of the three marks of existence shows the importance of that very specific insight that the Buddha taught. And again, insight into the three marks of existence. And
right,
so,
right.
You know, I think you see too, the reason why I'm going through these suttas on jhana now is that it naturally flows into some of the three marks of existence.
Yeah.
It's a really great and perceptive question, Jen. Thank you. The Sama then says, Venerable Ananda, all true teachers deserve a fee. I will pay homage to you. The Sama then gathered the Sanghas from Vasali and Pataliputta and prepared a feast for them. He gave a pair of cloths to each Sangha member and a triple robe to Ananda. That's the greatest honor he could have given Ananda. He then built a dwelling for Venerable Ananda. That's the end of the sutta. And, you know, if any of you are really inclined to building me a dwelling, go ahead. what a marvelous sutta. It's so clear and direct on what we're doing in meditation. Do you all see it that way? That this is what we look for in meditation. And that's the point. Let me start with Jane. Jane, how are you tonight? And do you have anything to add?
I'm fine.
Good.
My meditation is very simplistic. I mean, to be honest, I don't think about, you know, I don't evaluate or, I mean, I just do it. By the end, I usually meditate for a half an hour, and by the end, it's like, I don't know, sometimes I think I have like peaceful abiding. I mean, there's no directed thought, just I'm there.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like you're developing jhana as it's meant to be developed. Do you notice, though, passing through these different levels?
I don't really think about it. I mean, I just noticed that when I get to the end, I'm just in this place. It's very peaceful.
Yeah, that's the right
place.
Peaceful abiding.
There's no, it's just there.
Would you say that over the over time your concentration has increased?
I notice when I'm off the cushion that my concentration has increased.
Yes, good. You're doing a correct jhana practice. Congratulations.
Okay.
I'm glad you joined us tonight. Jen, how about you?
I would say that the idea of jhana really struck me on the last retreat, and kind of this idea of persistently focusing on the breath and persistently observing the arising and the passing away of internal phenomena. It's felt more like right effort. Like it felt more like I was doing something.
Yeah.
I don't even like to say it that way, but it was like, oh, I have to actually do this. I can't just kind of sit back and wait for, you know, the things to happen. It has to be, I need to direct my thoughts.
Yep.
Breath, I need to direct my thoughts to watching the arising of anatta and then abandoning it. And I have to just keep doing that in meditation. And that deepened my meditation. So yeah.
That's
and I do think the right effort and the right, I think right effort is really implied in the sutta. It's, because it's like, even when you reach jhana one, yep, gotta keep right effort. Reach jhana two, gotta keep right effort. And then even beyond that, when it goes beyond talking about the jhanas, talking about more meditative absorption, it keeps saying, but that's still fabrication, that's still fabrication. And that implies you need to continue to focus on watching anatta as it pass away.
Yeah, wow.
So I got out of it.
That's beautiful, Jen. That is it. And when I could see a lot of understanding of the Eightfold Path framing what you just said about that one factor of the Eightfold Path, jhana practice. It's just that way. And that understanding develops over time. you heard these words when you first started meditation, but they make the even the idea. If I said, "Do you know what directed thought means?" Everybody knows what it means, don't you? Mm-hmm. But applying it to something that we're not familiar with in a meaningful way takes time. And again, that's the reason why the Buddha taught these suttas, the reason why we're doing it here. So we understand exactly what directed thought and evaluation means during a meditation practice. So, thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Gosh, we've covered a lot of ground tonight. I understand directed thought. You know, but actually to drop your anatta thoughts and direct your thoughts onto the breath in the moment, I find that very hard. You know, I just want to carry on with my own thoughts of who I am and my own anatta thoughts, and I find it very hard to wish to leave that behind, or not even wish to leave, but just to drop it. You know, just to drop it as my instructions are. I find that very hard.
And yet you do it.
I could do it better.
Oh, but, yeah.
You know, there are times when I look at my, when I'm caught up in my own thinking, and I don't. I know I'm doing it, but I don't drop it.
Do you notice the development, same question I asked Jane, do you notice the development of increased concentration?
Yes.
That's what meditation is for. You are engaged in right meditation. And that evaluating part is best to be dispassionate, meaning it's good to notice that you still are finding yourself caught up in your thoughts, but if there's any self-judgment about that, and I'm not saying there are, but if there is, it's best to just let that go. Because remember, that this what we do on our cushion stays on our cushion. It's not helpful to take it off our cushion, except to recognize that concentration is increasing. That's what we should take off our cushion.
Mm.
And you're doing it. So,
when I said that, I was meaning off my cushion.
Oh, but off your cushion, do you notice increased concentration? And I would say in your case, increased seclusion, because you've talked about that.
Yeah. And having the veil, you know, between, you know, life and getting caught up in life and keeping not caught up in life. Yes, I try to develop that veil.
Yeah.
But I must admit sometimes I just, I'm not 100% on my practice every minute of the day and all that. So no, that's not me. That's too hard.
I don't think you should be part of our sangha anymore, because everybody else here is 100%.
Voter off the island. Member.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. I'm not really sure I have anything to add, so I'm going to take note of the silence and reread this and think about it a little more.
I'm glad you're here. July 18th, Thursday, we're going to have a meeting of our teacher's training. Good. You can make it that date?
I can make that.
Beautiful. Good evening, Ron.
Good. that evaluation. First jhana is going. That was a long process. And it had to go from that stage of really thinking, oh, I'm doing all this wrong, but it's not wrong, it's not wrong, to at this point it's more I'm realizing how powerful these mind forces are. That they just want to really persist in distracting.
Yep.
It's an amazingly strong force. But I can, at this point, I can let that be its own force. but it, I have to drop this, this fabrication of that there, there should be an end to this, these distractions. And there's not going to be an end to the things that come up as distractions. The end is in being distracted.
And coming back to the breath, yeah.
And they're still going to go on and just return to the breath.
Yeah.
And it's like chipping away at a rock.
Yeah, but even the rock is fabricated. And as the Buddha says, that it's like foam on the ocean, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
But because of it's the nature of ignorance is mm-hmm. so powerful and so subtle that it seems like it's almost insurmountable. But it's not, because ultimately there's nothing really there except our own ignorance.
Right.
And when we develop wisdom where there was once ignorance, the provocation of ignorance is gone. Just like that.
Yeah, but the pervasive increase in concentration off the cushion, that's there, and that I take great joy in that.
Yeah, and it really is. It's remarkable. I mean, I notice it in myself often that just how pleasant it is to be concentrated and not distracted over ordinary things. I used to. You know, just I was always be distracted, but all of it's a common human problem. Is you've heard me say it before. The Buddha could have almost as accurately described the first noble truth as there is distraction, as saying there is dukkha, because it's the preoccupation with dukkha that distracts us from living our life. Constantly, it's just that. Glad you're here, Kate. Good to see you tonight. How have you been, and how are you?
Good.
Good.
Sorry, I haven't been here in a while. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you back.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. Glad you joined us tonight. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. Good to see everybody. I think what Jane said about the simplicity of it. So to me, acknowledging the different jhanas is a bit of a distraction rather than having that. I mean, you have rising and the passing of thoughts and coming back to the breath, you know, applying the right effort to that. So like Jen, that's what I do. I just come back to it. But I don't do the evaluation of is this 1, 2, 3, or 4. I think I just sort of have a collective experience from it. And when I come back to the breath, the in-breath becomes, in my mind, rising, and the out-breath becomes the passing, and I, as if any thought comes during those moments, I just try to breathe them in or breathe them out and not dwell on them. So, you know, the simplicity of how Jane goes through her meditation resonates with me. And coming back to the breath and applying the effort to see it as rising, and the any thoughts as rising and passing resonates with me. And the thought of evaluating where I am, what resonates with me is Kevin saying, I'm going to go do some more reading and think about it some more. Because you know, right now that doesn't really fit in with how I meditate, you know, really thinking about, gee, do I feel elated, or, you know, I don't do that.
So. Do you recognize going through these different levels?
You know, I honestly don't know if I do. I mean, I'm very cognizant of my breath, and perhaps the closest thing to recognizing a level is the amount of space between recognizing the rising and passing of a thought. So if I'm just not even aware of thoughts passing, I'm just, you know, my mind is more spacious in those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And then the distractions are when a thought comes in, and then I just dispel it, disperse it. And so I'm not sure that I'm recognizing different levels of pleasure or
Well, I perhaps you will now, and but.
But see, then I see that as a distraction.
Well, it shouldn't be used as a distraction. It simply should be this sutta and the suttas on jhana give us a framework or a benchmark to evaluate our dhamma, our meditation practice. But that's all. It shouldn't be. We shouldn't be trying to force these levels. We should do just as you're describing, begin meditation. But it's also helpful in a broad sense to recognize that we have developed these three or four levels of jhana. Simply as a way of evaluating our own meditation practice. Are we doing it correctly? It sounds like you're doing that.
So what if I evaluate it off the cushion? Like, oh, that was a good one. Rather than when I'm there, because then it's like, oh, that was better than the last one, and I wonder what the next one will be like. And
what I would say, Helen, is that it would be beneficial to you if you would hold in mind the intention to recognize these different levels without allowing them to be a distraction. Because they are something that, the reason why I asked you, did you experience these, is because you must have, if you're describing the results of your meditation practice, you're just not noticing it. And that's, again, the Buddha didn't teach jhana as achievement. He taught to notice these different levels of meditative absorption. That's all. If we start chasing after it, we've lost it. If we, I'm going to get to the third jhana quick tonight.
Right.
We're not. It's not going
to
work.
It seems to me the difference is in the eye making. Right?
It is.
Like achievement has eye making in it, where recognition does not. So
yep.
Like having an aha moment that you learn from and say, oh, I just learned something about becoming or dependent origination or whatever, but not putting the eye into it. Or like experiencing wisdom off your cushion, but not doing it like a happy dance inside, you know, because then you're just introducing eye making to it. Is that?
Yep, that's the point. Yeah. If you see the levels as achievement, you're missing the point. But it is important to recognize that your practice is bearing fruit by noticing this. And I would bet, Helen, if you think about it a little bit, you would realize that you have noticed your deepening concentration related to this, to the Buddha's description of jhana. I would bet. Thank you. Barry?
I sort of, you know, already said it, that one of the things I heard and read, for me, I noticed the subtleties of eye making that can creep into your, that are in your practice, right? Because I'm still, you know, on the journey. So that was like a key takeaway for me, that to remove the eye-making from your right, you know, can't be right view if it has eye-making in it, but to recognize when that's happening in your practice. I guess I hadn't thought about it that way. I've thought about recognizing eye-making in my life or in my conversation or my leadership in my work or my role in the family, those kind of things, but I never really thought about it in my practice.
Uh-huh.
But it's also that, like, when you first learn what eye-making is and you realize it doesn't just mean the traditional egoic things that you think when you see someone is operating with a big ego, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we learned that that's not all that eye making means.
Yeah, it's more subtle than that.
Right, exactly. And so to look at yourself and recognize that other form of ego, other form of eye making, and where that exists for you in the Eightfold Path, your experience with the Eightfold Path and your experience. I mean, I don't have that on the cushion, but maybe in thinking about or evaluating my practice, maybe sometimes I do. So anyway, that was my takeaway, is I just never thought about that before.
Good.
And that was some subtle insight. So
thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
David, good evening.
I've always thought
much of the teachings are roadmaps. And teachings like the hindrances, or teachings like the jhanas, it's to make you aware of what you're going to be experiencing. Okay. So you understand as you sit that you understand that this is what's occurring.
Yeah.
And ill will arise, so you should recognize that. You should know what the fourth jhana is, so if you touch upon it, you're aware of it. So to me, a lot of the teachings are that these roadmaps that the Buddha lays out as a teacher. Because I'm sure oftentimes the embellishments were because it wasn't enough. And Buddha is saying, this is what you're going to experience. So I've always seen it as a true teachings of what you'll experience as much as some of the deeper things like becoming, specific things that are a little more heady. But some of this is just basic road mapping of what you'll experience. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could, the Buddha's Dhamma is just like that. He teaches us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. It's just like, and that's it. And one of the things we should do is to recognize that that our concentration is increasing by measuring it against these different levels.
Just as a
way of an internal check on it, this is the way to evaluate Dhamma practice, meditation practice.
Gaining concentration to understand the three marks and primarily impermanence.
And that's another important component of this, is to understand that the insight we're gaining is very specific and directed towards three marks of existence, and not to common human problems or anything else that would be fabricated, is it? I'm not looking for a reason for suffering. I understand the reason for suffering. My own ignorance of the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a path of development. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you.
See you. I think I see it, my practice, as to view it in a non-judgmental way.
Yep.
To observe without judgment.
Yep.
And that's, to me, that's been a gift to, and I can engage with compassion for myself. Like one of the last things you say is, take a look at the quality of your mind and be at peace with the quality of your mind. So whether I'm meditating for a month or a year or 10 years, there might be times when it's going to be busy mind, but to be able to recognize, what it is, when it is.
Yeah.
And then, I think that's for me, something I hold in mind.
Thank you. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Just two things. I think that understanding or recognizing the different levels of the jhana is just part of, come see for yourself. And to do a check every once in a while. And if you don't feel you've reached a higher level of concentration, what is it that you can change in your own behavior to make that more possible? Are you sitting twice a day? Are you carrying the Dhamma with you throughout the day? Things that you can check on yourself. And then the other thing was something that Ram said about, I had, and this just triggered my thought, I don't know if it's exactly what Ram was thinking, but the whole idea of awakening can be seen sometimes as like a page in a book that you're eventually going to get to. It's not really like that. It's that one day that the feeling arises, the fabrication arises, all of that arises, but you're able to get on top of it and let go of it. And then that happens over and over and over again until you're at a point where, in most situations, you can check those feelings arising, the emotions and fabrications and consciousness of all of it, and then just let it go. So it's not that those feelings and mental fabrications, it's not that those at some point stop when you've awakened. It's just that now you have a concentrated mind that can get on top of it and let it go.
Beautifully said. That.
So
you're describing a human being with the ability to stay present in the world, in their life as their life occurs, without being entangled in the world. Maybe a simpler way of saying that is that you have disentangled all your past views that were clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas, no longer are. And again, look at the picture. You can see that that's a calm and well-concentrated mind that can do that, right? I mean, that's it. Simply present with life as life occurs.
So I had listened to Saturday's talk when I was out for a walk. And you've probably said it 150 times, but when I listened to Saturday's class, I understood it differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And that Dhamma is just that way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I wore yellow so you'd see me back.
Thank you.
You should wear those halo things that you wear at concerts. Light up the background.
Well, I was too busy listening to everybody to form a whole lot of my own thoughts, which I guess is good. But I will say that when I do meditate, it takes me a while for my mind to settle down.
Yeah.
But it does. And so I kind of need to think about the levels, but I think I'm getting to those levels as things start to settle down in my mind.
Yeah.
I feel more concentrated. So that's my initial comment.
Well, yeah, thank you. So you're describing at the second level at least, and I would bet that you flowed into the third level and maybe even a bit of the fourth. And these aren't levels of achievement. They're just there to be recognized. This is a consequence of right meditation, of using the proper method within the proper framework. Right, you're here. Nick, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. As always, I have a question.
Please.
When I was reading it today, I said that the levels seem to me to be counterintuitive to what the teachings are. And that human nature is to strive to achieve the next level. So if I'm trying to achieve the next level, isn't that like I making?
Yes, and that's why the Buddha teaches it this way. Human nature is, by definition within the framework of the Buddha's teaching, human nature is nature rooted in ignorance, and it's always grasping. And so, yes, it is contrary to human nature. The entire Buddha's Dhamma is contrary to human nature,
mm-hmm.
which is really the difficulty that we have with actually developing it until we understand that our idea of human nature is a fabricated idea. It's human nature, true human nature, to be free of conflict, to be present with life as life unfolds. That's true human nature. Another word for it is true human maturity. So you bring up a very good point. It's something that people come up against often, especially in the beginning of Dhamma practice. This goes against everything that I hold dear. It does.
So
but everything you hold dear is contributing to your confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences.
Mm. So isn't it more of a matter of of recognition. You're just recognizing that you're in a different space, that you're, the concentration you've developed has, it's kind of like all of a sudden you look around and things are a little bit better, and there's a little bit less stress.
Yeah.
And that your relationships might be a little bit different.
Yes, and ultimately, what you are understanding is that you yourself are developing a quality of mind that's appropriate for a human life. It works in this environment. Again, this is the idea of not going to a speculative non, you know, what good is that? The Buddha teaches us how to live in this plane of existence, in an impermanent realm. And he teaches us how to see the environment clearly and our relationship to the environment clearly. That's what awakening means, full human maturity. We're able to live a life. And there, it does seem overwhelming, doesn't it? Or it can. But it really isn't. It's a simple and direct path. The challenge is coming up against our own conditioned views, our own human nature. You know? But it's certainly doable. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people, ordinary people, awaken during the Buddha's time. Not just a handful. And by the way, we're all doing exactly what Ananda and Sariputta and Moggallana and the Buddha did 2,600 years ago. This is what they did. They did jhana. Any other questions or comments? Okay. We'll finish. We'll finish with metta as we always do. I think we're going to have one last class on jhana, maybe not, and then we're going to get into the three marks of existence. So find your relaxed meditation posture and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.